From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. For decades, Nadine Gordimer has been one of South Africa's leading literary voices for racial equality. On this edition of Fresh Air, Nadine Gordimer on being a white writer in South Africa. Also today, Boss Gags talks with us about his career before, during, and after his recent 7-year hiatus from recording. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of arias by German baritone Olaf Baer. And critic Ken Tucker falls under the spell of a self-hypnosis video. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Nadine Gordimer is one of South Africa's best-known writers. She's a longtime opponent of her country's racist policies and has written about the agonies of apartheid in her novels and short stories. In July's People, she imagined life during civil war. In A Sport of Nature, she projected a vision of black majority rule. Gordimer is a vice president of PEN, the International Writers Organization. Her new book, The Essential Gesture, is a collection of essays written between the early 1950s and 1985. Many of these pieces are about what it means to be a writer in South Africa and where, as a white woman, she sees herself fitting into the fight against apartheid. Gordimer told me that she's still shaken up by the assassination a couple of weeks ago of David Webster, a professor who worked with and studied the anti-apartheid movement. I asked Gordimer why she thinks he was gunned down.
Well, he was a social anthropologist teaching at the University of the Witwatersrand, but he was very much concerned with the fate of detainees, people who are arrested, taken into prison, and not charged. These are political offenders, so-called, and they are often kept for weeks, months, years before they're charged or they are released. Most recently, there was a big countrywide hunger strike mounted by these detainees because many of them had been in so long and couldn't get themselves released and were not charged. They didn't know what they were there for, just simply held. So that would be one reason, his involvement with publicising the hunger strike. He also did a lot of writing on civil rights issues and political issues and spoke in public on them. And he was in the process of writing, I think it was going to be a small book, about the methods used to suppress opposition in South Africa, opposition against apartheid. And he'd examined all the different things that are used by the state, banning people, restricting their movements, detaining them, and so on. And he'd come to the conclusion that nothing really stopped people who were determined to oppose apartheid except right-wing terrorism in the form of assassination. And he was writing this on the Friday, and on the 1st of May, May Day, public holiday in South Africa, he was shot dead from a passing car outside his own house.
Do you think that this is a paradox, or do you think that the assassins knew the conclusions he was arriving at in his research?
Oh, I think they did, because he had been publishing bits and pieces of it here and there.
I see.
And maybe they felt that something about them and their methods that would lead to their being brought to justice was going to come out in this.
Well, his theory was that the only effective intimidation was assassination. Now that another friend of yours has been assassinated, what effect does it have on you and on your courage?
Well, it has an effect on all of us. And indeed, he was the one who pinpointed it, that when somebody is simply shot down by unknown assailants like that, it's not a risk that you know you're taking. You know that you risk being detained. You know that you risk losing your passport. But you don't think about being shot down outside your own house. And it certainly is something that sent a ripple of fear through activists against apartheid. But people still find the courage, just as he did always, to go on. He had the most enormous funeral, with tremendous support from blacks who filled the streets outside the cathedral where the service was held. He was greatly loved by people of all colours and had a tremendous following among black people. So he was a living proof of the non-racial nature of the struggle against injustice in South Africa.
Are funerals like that legal now?
Well, no, not. They very often are stopped. But I think the government was so embarrassed over this assassination, whether they were involved, whether the police were involved with it or not, that probably for the sake of world opinion, they could not. They didn't feel they could ban that funeral, and it turned into an enormous political anti-apartheid demonstration. They were there with the police and dogs, and I've never seen such an enormous police presence. But there was no violence. Nothing happened. It passed off peacefully.
Are you in need of causes for optimism in order to continue the work that you're doing?
Well, I think there are causes for optimism. Even in the tragic instance of the incident I've just told you about, when you see black and white people coming together in the mass out of respect and love for a man like David Webster, you feel optimism vis-a-vis the fears that people express to me here in America and outside, that whites, there'll be no place for whites in South Africa when we have black majority rule. I don't believe this, and I keep seeing evidence that it is not so. It depends upon whites. It depends how they behave. It depends which side they show they're on now, not just out of their mouths, but out of their actions as well.
Nadine Gordimer is my guest. I'm curious about when you became aware of apartheid. You grew up in South Africa. Your parents were emigres, your mother from London, your father, I think, from Lithuania. You grew up in a mining town. When did you become aware of apartheid?
Well, I think I was quite a late developer, really, when I consider the awareness, political awareness of my own children a generation later. But in that small town, you know how it is, particularly in a small town where you're not open to many other mind-blowing influences. You tend to adopt the attitudes and the mores of your parents and your teachers and so on. And I just took it as natural as a child that I went to a segregated school. I went to a convent school. All the kids were white. And that the only people, only blacks that I was in touch with were people doing the menial jobs, sweeping the streets, acting as servants, messengers, and so on. I mean, they were all around. And of course, as it was a mining town, there were thousands of black migratory miners who lived in their compounds, as we call them, barracks, quite near where we lived, but were completely separate from us, not only by language, but they just had no part in our lives. But when I was a great reader, and I really came to think about apartheid in terms of class injustice from reading people like Upton Sinclair when I was a teenager. And then I began to look around me, and I began to write very young. And by the time I was 17, I think the first published story that I wrote was indeed about apartheid, not in a formula form, but as it affected the lives of the people that I knew. It was about a police raid on a house for illicit liquor brewing by the black servant.
Was opposing apartheid, did that also mean that you had to oppose your parents? Did your parents support the system?
Well, my father, I think, did. You must remember that when I was a child, the word apartheid hadn't even been coined. And the apartheid government only came into power in 1948 when I was grown up. I'm talking about the 30s. Mm-hmm. And at that time, it was a sort of colonial racism with quite a lot of paternalism mixed up in it. My mother had a social conscience, and she did good works, and I don't say that sneeringly. She was one of the people who helped form a creche and clinic for black children in the nearby black ghetto, which we called township then. And she was always uneasy and angry if she saw black people being treated badly. But it was always as a form of charity. She didn't connect it with the law. She didn't connect it with the fact that they didn't have rights as white people had.
Was writing for you a response to injustice, or do you think you would have become a writer one way or another?
writing was not a response to injustice. I wasn't even aware of injustice. I began to write out of a sense of wonder at life and also out of the mystery of life, wanting to find out what it was all about. It was my way of exploring life. And I think this is true of all artists. That's at the base of what we do. I don't think that any real artist begins from a political stimulation or conscience.
In the 1950s, you became friends with many black writers. Were there many obstacles at that time to developing friendships between black and white writers?
Yes, there were. But I think, as everywhere in the world, probably in the United States as well, writers and artists, actors, journalists have tended to be people who don't really fit in to a conventional pattern of life and have more in common with one another and with the things that interest and absorb them, which cross colour, race, language, everything. And I think that this was true in South Africa as well. I had so much more in common with some young black person who was beginning to write than I had with the people in that mining town. So it was community of interest.
Did the people in your mining town see you as a traitor?
Well, I left there when I was quite young, and I don't know how they saw me. And while I was there and was quietly writing, it was very much a sort of secret activity. Nobody was particularly interested in it, which I think was a good thing for me. It left me to develop in my own way. I think they were a bit annoyed when my first book was published. My mother was still living there because it was set in a town like that, and first books are usually have quite a strong autobiographical element. So I think there was a bit of name spotting, you know, this is so-and-so and that's based on whatnot and tut-tut-tut, how could she do this?
Right. Nadine Gordimer is my guest, and she has a new collection of essays called The Essential Gesture. In one of your essays from 1959, you ask the question, where do whites fit in the new Africa? Nowhere, I'm inclined to say. What was the vision of the new Africa in the late 1950s?
Well, it was exciting, and it was strange that down in the south there, in the big toe of the continent, it seemed hardly to affect us at all. And this was partly due to lack of communication. It's always been much easier. And whites in South Africa have always been very Eurocentric. And indeed, when I was a young girl and a beginning writer, it was a dream of everybody then to go to London or to go to Paris. How could you possibly be a writer sitting, you know, in Johannesburg? Fortunately, I didn't ever have the money to go, and I think it was very fortunate because why become an expatriate for no reason and lose your background and your home? I'm a bit worried about that essay because many people don't notice that, as you did, that it was dated 59. It's a very long time ago. I didn't alter any of my opinions or bring them up to date in that book because I thought a personal book like this shows the development of one's opinions and one's responses to one's time in society. But I obviously, in 1959, doubted whether there would be a place for whites to continue to live in Africa. But so far as South Africa is concerned, I certainly don't believe that now. And I haven't believed it for many years. I'm quite sure that there is a place for whites, that the African National Congress, the Premier Liberation Movement has always been non-racial, still is. And it's simply a matter, it's not a simple matter for many whites, it's a matter of whites learning how to live in a different way, truly accepting what is coming, which is black majority rule, and not fearing, not wanting guarantees of group rights, which will set them aside, set them apart, mark them out forever. We've never had a Bill of Rights in South Africa. I think if the rights of the individual are guaranteed, what do you want to need to guarantee group rights for? You're only keeping the demarcation of colour and class there forever. I think whites certainly have a big part to play in the future free, non-racial South Africa, but they must learn to live differently. They can't be wanting to be the boss and ordering other people around and doing their thinking for them.
I've heard some whites in South Africa who've done liberal or radical work say that they fear, nevertheless, that if there is a revolution, there will be so much unleashed rage against white people, and understandably so, and this rage will not discriminate against white people who've been against apartheid and white people who've supported it, and on an individual basis, a lot of people won't know the difference. You know, people won't be wearing ID cards. Do you ever worry about that?
No, I must say I don't. I'm interested to hear that this should have come to you from people who have been active, because this is the kind of fear that comes from people who've never done anything with blacks.
Oh, I won't mention names here, but there's one person in particular who said that to me, who I'm thinking of.
Yes. I think it might have been true, it was true, in the 70s during the separatist, black separatist time.
Mm-hmm.
But now with the United Democratic Front still operating under great difficulty, half banned, in the 80s there's been a great revival of democratic action across the colour line. And to return for a moment to the funeral of David Webster, the size of that funeral, the blacks and whites standing there squashed together, shoulder and shoulder together, singing the same freedom songs, and the feeling of absolute unity of purpose and unity of sorrow. If you have that, you cannot feel that there is going to be great animosity against whites. There will be against some whites because they do terrible things and people will not forget. There are certain individuals who've done terrible things.
Was there a moment or a period where you stopped fluctuating between staying in South Africa or leaving and you just decided to stay?
Oh, there have really only been in my life one or two moments when I thought at all of leaving South Africa.
What were those moments?
Well, actually, they were in the 60s when, through personal circumstances, I could have gone to live in Zambia. And I went, I'd been travelling quite a bit in Central Africa generally, Tanzania, Kenya, Zambia. And I had what I realised later was a romantic idea that I could then commit myself to an African country as an African. Whereas in South Africa, there was the struggle against white supremacists in the 60s. You must remember it was after Sharpeville. The African National Congress was banned. The other liberation movements were banned. And there was just a feeling of total stalemate that the apartheid government was going to be there forever. And I didn't want to spend my life as a white living in the white lager, struggling to keep contact with blacks. But I think fortunately for me, I discovered on visits to Zambia, much as I liked the country and the people, that there I was just regarded as a European. I was just a white person like people from expatriates from England working there or from any other country. Whereas at home, in my own country, there's never been a time when I felt I wasn't recognized as a white African.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to talk with you more about South Africa and about your writing, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is Nadine Gordimer. Her latest book is a collection of essays called The Essential Gesture, including essays written between 1950 and 1985. We'll be back after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest Nadine Gordimer is the author of many collections of short stories as well as novels. Her books include A Sport of Nature, July's People, The Lying Days, and Something Out There. Now, I believe three of your books have been censored, is that right?
Three of my books have been banned over the years in South Africa. But lately, nothing of mine has been banned. And I optimistically hope that nothing will be. I think there's a certain protection becoming well known outside. As I've become better known in the outside world, it has seemed hardly worthwhile for the government to ban a writer like myself, not a terribly easy writer to read, so that I think the calculation is that it's not worth the fuss that there is when a Book of Mormon is banned, the fuss that there is in the outside world as well as at home. But in any case, censorship, the real clout of censorship, has moved from the censorship banning of books to that of muzzling the press. The real heat is on the press, the media generally.
Mm-hmm. Is censorship almost a badge of honor? When your book has been censored, you know, knowing that the government was so outraged by it that they don't even want other people to read it.
Yes, I suppose so in a way, but really for me that's offset by the fact that it cannot be read by your own people then. Mm-hmm. But as I say, now very few works of fiction are banned, and even quite tough non-fiction works. This is also because if they're on a certain level, they're not going to find a very large reading public. And you must remember there's complete control of television. It's all state television. People like myself don't write for television. We don't appear in discussion programs. We are muzzled in this way.
Well, while we're talking about press censorship, are there underground ways of information being spread that have developed in the light of press censorship?
Well, there are. There are indeed. But
none that you could talk about.
They are really quite dangerous. Yeah. And one of them we have just talked about, back to David Webster, that he was one of the people engaged in bringing news from the detainees on hunger strike in the prisons. And as you can see, this is a dangerous thing to do.
Well, let me read to you a statement that you once said about writing. You said that the best way to write is to do so as if one were already dead, afraid of no one's reactions, answerable to no one's views. What led you to say that? And I guess I wonder if you've taken heat by, on both sides in South Africa.
No, this was just a conviction that goes really deeper than that. I think that a writer must always maintain the independence, the artistic independence, to use his or her insights, something that a writer has beyond the insights of other people, without worrying whether you're going to offend your mother, your best friend, or whether your political confreres are going to decide that you have let down the side. A writer must never let herself become a propagandist. Propagandists have a place, agitprop has a place, but I'm not that kind. I'm not that person. I'm a writer. I have a certain ability, and I feel the first duty is to use that ability properly. The nearest you can get to the truth, you get through using that ability properly, not worrying what anybody's going to say. That's why I would stand by that old statement, you know, that you must write as if you're already dead and not worry about the consequences. Because as soon as you've got your eye on an audience, on people who are watching, you're going to hear what you have to say, you're going to falsify that little extra vision you have that will bring you near to the truth. And in the end, if we look at your position, the writer's position in society, the essential gesture to society, in the end, it is what you're going to be able to record and discover of the truth that is going to serve your society best.
Do you feel that you've ever been expected to write books that would be more effective propaganda?
Oh, yes, indeed.
Where has that pressure come from?
Well, it hasn't really been pressure, and it hasn't usually come from quarters that bothered me very much. Because I feel that if I took no part in community life and lived in an ivory tower, then perhaps I might listen to it. But I'm also a human being, a citizen, and I know that I have a certain responsibility toward my society for what's happened there, what's happened in my name as a white, whether I had anything to do with it or not. And so I have another part of my life which where I put my life on the line for what I believe in. And I think, therefore, I have the freedom to write as I feel I must, as I please. I'm not retiring into an ivory tower because I am doing other things as a human being and a citizen.
We talked a little earlier about how in the 1950s you became good friends with many black writers from South Africa. Is it any more difficult now to keep connections like that? What I mean is, do government restrictions make it really difficult to get together and to communicate?
No, only insofar as you know that when you're in organizations like our new writers' organization, of which I was one of the founders, it's only just going to be 2 years old in July. It's very young still. We know that we are watched because part of our preamble to our constitution is that we are committed to the liberation of South Africa. We are committed to working with and encouraging a grassroots culture, which means working with the cultural groups in trade unions. We make no excuses for it. We are a political organization because culture is political. We want to create a new culture. We know that we're watched when some of our members, not through directly through their activities with us, but through other activities, have been detained. They're quite closely questioned about us. So that there isn't anything in the that you do across the colour line without racial division, or even with racial division, if it's against the regime, that it doesn't bring you some kind of risk. But you can still mix as a writer with your black colleagues, if you wish, as long as you have what is really in common. First of all, the desire to do good work, and secondly, to understand your responsibility as a writer to other people who are struggling to learn to write, who have had fewer educational opportunities. And this applies to blacks as well as whites, because you have some of our writers, black writers, that teach in universities or run alternative education establishments. In other words, they're white-collar people. And there are lots and lots of people in the trade unions, among mine workers, peasants in the country, who long to write and to read. They don't have the libraries and they don't have the ability to express themselves. We feel it's part of our duty of being writers to work with them and help them.
It's interesting. You see it as a political responsibility.
Yes. It's a political and a professional and artistic responsibility.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned a new organization of writers that you helped to found. What is it called?
It's called the Congress of South African Writers, COSOR. And it's really spreading out into the country. We try to get away from the concentration in the big cities with our readings and workshops. And we are about 95% black membership now. But by black, I mean we call black people that you call coloured, people who are of Indian descent, people who are of mixed blood and so on. But we have a 95% black membership.
One last question. What do you need to do to make sure that the organization doesn't get banned and get forced underground?
Well, we can't do anything, because then we would be stifling our real convictions. We simply go on doing what we think is right, and we're prepared to take the consequences.
I thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you. My guest has been South African writer Nadine Gordimer. She has a new collection of essays from 1950 to 1985. The book is called The Essential Gesture, and it's published by Knopf. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, we'll feature a concert with jazz pianist Dave McKenna. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. In the mid-70s and early 80s, Boz Scaggs was a fixture at the top of the charts, but he dropped out of the music scene for nearly 7 years, returning last year with a new record. Coming up, Boz Scaggs talks with us about his hits and his long absence. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new album of Mozart arias performed by East German baritone Olaf Baer. And if you doubt your ability to cope with the modern world, Ken Tucker has the home video for you. It's called Incredible Self-Confidence. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. Official Radio Beijing has branded rebel Chinese students counter-revolutionaries, a move some fear could mean that army troops will soon move against them. Thursday morning newscast included a call from military leaders for soldiers to obey martial law directives of hardline Premier Li Peng. Students have already labeled Li the counter-revolutionary and are demanding his resignation. The BBC's Mark Brain reports.
In a letter to the senior bodies of the Chinese state, the party and the government, student leaders accused Premier Li Peng of attempting no less than a counter-revolutionary coup d'etat. Like demonstrators this week in their millions across China, the students demand Mr. Li's resignation, but they say he should also be expelled immediately from the Communist Party and brought to account. Otherwise, the student leaders say, they'll relaunch the hunger strike, whose beginnings just 11 days ago exploded into the present student occupation of the whole of Peking, and with it, China's biggest political earthquake in a generation. They may not need, however, to go into action. Signals from the inner circles of power here suggest that the hero of the protests, Mr. Zhao Ziyang, the reformist leader of the Communist Party, is back in the saddle and looking a great deal stronger. 5 days after Premier Li proclaimed but then utterly failed to enforce martial law in Peking, residents of this city remain on guard.
Mark Brain in Beijing. President Bush today told graduates of the Coast Guard Academy that he welcomes new arms reduction proposals by Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev, but he said they did not go far enough to reduce the advantage enjoyed by Warsaw Pact forces. During the commencement address, Bush said he is optimistic about the chances to negotiate further weapons reductions. Earlier today, administration officials had high praise for the Soviet military initiative made yesterday in Vienna. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater told reporters that the president regarded it as meaningful and serious. Jim Wright is reportedly ready to step down as Speaker of the House. Sources say Wright's attorneys have been working with the House Ethics Committee to find a way for the Speaker to resign gracefully. Publicly, Wright reiterated his pledge to remain in office until the case against him is resolved. But sources say Wright would resign if the panel drops the most damaging charges against him. Wright's lawyer argued before the committee yesterday that the entire investigation is the result of a political vendetta. But Republican committee member John Myers today rejected Wright's complaint.
This is not a retaliation. That's an insult to members of this committee. There are 12 of us, 6 Democrats and 6 Republicans. We're not here for a political vendetta, not for a political vendetta of any sort whatsoever. We're here to sit in judgment if the Speaker has violated the rules of the House.
Wright faces dozens of allegations of unethical conduct, including using his influence to benefit a business partner. French police today arrested one of their country's most wanted war criminals. Paul Touvier was seized during a raid on a monastery near the southern city of Nice. Authorities say Touvier led a militia that collaborated with Nazi Germany in the French city of Lyon during World War II. According to French radio, religious authorities have been sheltering Touvier since the end of the war. Church sources say the 74-year-old man was captured in a monastery belonging to excommunicated Archbishop Marcel Lefebvre. Touvier has been flown to Paris for investigation. He is believed to have worked closely with Gestapo chief Klaus Barbie, the so-called Butcher of Lyon, who is serving a life prison term in France for crimes against humanity. Stock prices were higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 5 points to close at 2483.87. Advances led decline 7-6 on volume of 180 million shares. Average price of a share on the New York Exchange gained 7 cents. You're listening to NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Most of the recordings by the East German baritone Olaf Baer have featured German art songs, or Lieder. But classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of a new album by Baer of Mozart operatic arias. Here's a short selection from The Magic Flute.
Ein Mädchen oder Weibchen wünscht Papageno sich. Oh, so ein sanftes Träumchen wär Seligkeit für mich. Wär Seligkeit für mich. Wär Seligkeit für mich.
The only recordings I've ever heard before by East German baritone Olaf Baer have been his eloquent albums of German Lieder, songs by Schubert, Schumann, and Hugo Wolf. Now Angel has released a Mozart album that ought to be even more popular. The selection includes not only some of the best-loved baritone arias from The Marriage of Figaro, Don Giovanni, Così fan tutte, and The Magic Flute, but interesting arias from some relatively unfamiliar operas. There's one from Mozart's youthful La Finta Giardiniera, The Girl Disguised as a Gardener. Opera director Sarah Caldwell cleverly called her production of it Down the Garden Path. The character Nardo is in love with a maidservant. She makes him woo her as if he were a cavalier. He tries in Italian, French, and even English, but she remains unimpressed in any language.
You say yes. All my life, pray you, pray you, pray you say yes. All my life, pray you say yes.
Ei, das ist ja zu krepieren, die Geduld möcht man verlieren. Weder Englisch noch Französisch, weder Deutsch noch Italienisch, gar nichts steht hier an. Oh, das eigensinnige Mädchen.
There's also an aria from an opera that Mozart never quite finished or even titled, but which someone years after Mozart died named Zaid. And there are two relatively unfamiliar arias that Mozart wrote to be sung in operas by other composers. One of them, Un bacio di mano, A Kiss on the Hand, is a worldly wise love lesson not to fall in love too easily. The delightful little tune turns up only a few months later in Mozart's last symphony, The Jupiter.
Siete un po' tondo, mio caro Pompeo, l'usanze del mondo, andate a studiare, andate, andate, andate a studiare, andate, andate, andate a studiare.
Baer has a refined, light baritone voice, and he's a good musical actor. He makes fine vocal distinctions between the working-class anger of the servant Figaro, who fears his master is seducing his fiancée, and the aristocratic anger of the master, Count Almaviva, who fears his servant is mocking him. Baer's voice, though, isn't quite deep enough for the lowest notes, so he has to strain to hit them. They sound a little like angry growls. Sometimes he gets a little too nasty, especially when you expect him to be ironic. In the context of an opera production, that anger might be effective, justified by what came before. But in a recital, it seems excessive, even irritating, because we don't really feel what's motivating it. In Don Giovanni's champagne aria, he seems to be barking orders rather than preparing for a wild party. Una decina Bear seems best in Don Giovanni's suave serenade, or in more genial roles, like the birdcatcher Papageno in The Magic Flute. One of the most delightful numbers on the album is the complete scene in which Papageno, quite reluctantly, threatens to hang himself unless he finds a girl. But he's rescued at the last minute by his ideal mate, the bird woman Papagena, sung warmly by Uta Selbig. The orchestra is Bear's hometown band, the Staatskapelle Dresden. The twinkling, elegant playing under conductor Hans Funk is one of the major assets of this recording.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor for the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed a new recording of Olaf Bear singing Mozart arias on the EMI Angel label. This is Fresh Air. Many performers leave the music industry during a period of commercial failure, but it was just the opposite for Boss Skaggs in 1981 when he began a 7-year hiatus from recording. In 1980, he had 4 hit singles. His 1976 album, Silk Degrees, made it to the top 5 in both the pop and soul charts. It had the hits Lido Shuffle, We're All Alone, and Lowdown, which won a Grammy for Best Rhythm and Blues Song. It was just 1 year ago that Boss Skaggs returned with a new album, and he says he's ready to go back into the studio. He's lived in the San Francisco area since the late 60s when he was the guitarist in the Steve Miller Band. Now he owns a new San Francisco club called Slim's. This is Claudia from his latest album, Other Roads. Boss Skaggs, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry. Nice to be here.
Why did you decide to record again?
Well, it's been a part of music and writing songs has been a part of what I've done for a long time, and being away from it, that is in terms of an active career, was just kind of being away from it publicly and actively. I didn't leave it mentally.
You, in the late 60s, played in as the guitarist in the Steve Miller Band. This was like a blues band that was also one of the early psychedelic bands in the Bay Area. Was that a good time for you? Do you think of that as a good time for you, and do you listen back to those records?
It was a great time for me. I had been living in Europe for about 3 years before that, and I'd missed playing electric music as I had done in high school and for a year in college and sort of kicking around. So it was a return to me to electric guitar and playing in a band ensemble, and to record for the first time as a band some of my own songs. So it was an introduction to the studio scene. It was a first national tour. It was my first taste of professionalism, if you like.
Your first taste of professionalism was playing guitar, but not really singing. What brought the singing up front?
Being in the band at the time, well, let's to back up a little. I had been singing in Europe. That's sort of the way I've gotten around. It's also the means by which one gets one's songs out. More people are looking for material, perhaps nowadays, but in those days, in order to be a part of a band, express yourself more, you wrote your own songs and sang them usually.
I think the first record that people really noticed your singing on, it was the first record that you recorded in the States. The album was called Bus Gags. But I think the track that really kind of caught on was Somebody Loan Me a Dime, a Fenton Robinson song mm-hmm. that you recorded. What made you choose this song?
It was I like minor modes. I like basic blues. It's really where I came from, and it was my first real attachment to music. And we were also looking for a vehicle for an extraordinary musician, Duane Allman, who we had seen, and those who had sort of on the inside of that kind of music knew was an outstanding young musician. And it was a great vehicle for him as well to step out.
No, I cry. Just like a baby all night long. Ooh. Somebody better love me that time. I need my baby. I need my baby.
I've read, and maybe this is a story everybody knows about, I know I don't, a couple of articles referring to the record talk about how Duane Allman, the guitarist, was actually in the bathroom mm-hmm. during the session. Would you explain this?
Yeah. the room was, the actual recording studio was rather small by today's standards, and that particular song we wanted to record all live, all once, no overdubbing, no... just all at once, so all the musicians were crammed into the main studio room, and Duane was put into the little bathroom, which was actually just a cubicle built inside the studio itself, which was literally just big enough to close the door and turn around. And the reason for that was because he played loud. He had to, in order to get the tone from his guitar, he turned it up real. He used small speakers and turned it up loud, and we had to isolate him from the horns and from the acoustic instruments. And he perched atop the loo and let it rip.
What led you from a more blues-oriented kind of song, like we just heard, to the more soul and disco-oriented stuff that you were doing in the mid '70s?
I've always followed. Blues, rhythm and blues in its progressions. And at that time, or early 70s, mid-70s, I was listening to a lot of what they called it urban soul or urban black music at the time. It was music that was coming out of Detroit, Chicago, and Philadelphia primarily. I loved these stylings, and I followed them. And as that music became more sophisticated, I learned it. That's what I went to. I wasn't really trying to find a style or adopt a style. That's where that was where my heart was.
Let me ask you about one of your most successful records from that period, Dirty Lowdown. What did you hear in your mind? What did you know you wanted on that before it was recorded?
To answer that, I have to tell you that each, in preparation for each album, I chose the musicians, the studio, the producer, and in doing so, knew what the tone of the album was going to be. But I don't write songs until I get to the studio or the afternoon before.
Really?
I know what my elements are. I know who my characters are. It so happened that for the most part, during the recording of that album and the albums that immediately followed, we recorded 12 or 13 songs and used 9 or 10 or 11 of them. They're all experiments.
Babies in the running round, hanging with the crowd, putting your business in the street, talking out loud, saying you bought us this and that, and how much you done spent. I swear she must believe it's all heaven sent. Hey boy, better bring a check around to the sad, sad truth, the dirty low down.
One last question. You strike me as very kind of low-key in person, you know, like soft-spoken, which is very different from the kind of performance that you do on stage or the kind of effect you give off on record.
It's interesting.
You don't think so?
I don't know. I've never thought of it that way. I think you're probably a better judge than I am of that. I mean, I don't really come up with a persona that I'm going to be on a record. I do... you know, sort of fall more into music and all of its, in all of its characters on a record than I do. I won't burst into song here, and
oh, feel free.
Oh, this is. I wouldn't. I'm shy in that way. I couldn't speak to a room full of people. I could sing to a room of 10,000 or perform, but
you couldn't sing one-on-one. You'd be shy to do that.
I could sing one-on-one.
In the right circumstances.
In the right circumstances, yeah.
Right. Okay. I thank you very much for talking with
us. Thanks, Terry. Enjoyed being here.
Boss Gag spoke with us at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah, what stories are you following from China today?
China continues to be the lead story today, and we'll talk with Louis Benyan from this country. He's here now. He's one of China's leading dissidents, and he'll be discussing the power struggle within the leadership there. Also, a discussion of how the story is playing both in China, in Beijing, and around the country, and how it's being received by the press in Moscow and the people there. And one of the $19 million radar balloons operated by the Customs Service has been hit by some bad weather down over the border with Mexico. It's in the shop for $1 million worth of repairs. And Bob Garfield takes us to a snail ranch in St. Helena, California.
Thanks, Noah. That and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. In this age of self-improvement, we've probably all battled with some bad habit or struggled to overcome some personality flaw. Critic Ken Tucker has found a series of home videos that claim to be a powerful tool for creating a more perfect you.
A company called Valley of the Sun puts out nothing less than 24 different entries in its video hypnosis series. They offer titles like Stop Smoking Forever, Lose Weight Now, Ultra Monetary Success, and Attracting Love, which is subtitled Drawing Your Soulmate to You. But of all the titles the company could have sent me for review, they selected the one called Incredible Self-Confidence, exactly the one I might have chosen for myself, and thereby, even before I watched it, giving this company a lot of credibility in my book. I must admit that I was a little nervous about trying to hypnotize myself, but the booklet that accompanies the tape says that the creator of the series, Dick Sutphin, uses techniques that generate an eyes-open, dreamy state of consciousness. And since that's pretty much how I walk through life anyway, I figured, what did I have to lose? After all, didn't the box promise me that I would soon be full of self-reliance and self-confidence, independence and determination, and possessed of a very positive self-image? This was no time to be timid. So I popped the tape into the VCR and listened to Dick Sutphin's soothing opening remarks.
The tape you are about to watch is extremely powerful, incorporating visual and verbal hypnosis, plus audio and video subliminal suggestions. Although you will feel relaxed, most people do not realize they are in an eyes-open, altered state of consciousness when the countdown is complete. You will probably feel as you normally do while watching television.
Now, I gotta interrupt here. This didn't seem to bode well because, probably like you, the way I normally feel when watching television is faintly nauseous. But mindful that what I was getting here was, to again quote from Dick Sutphin's promotional material, the next step in brain-mind technology, I decided to press on. There were, by the way, no people on screen as I watched, just an undulating pattern of blue, a swirling abstract vortex design that sort of reminded me of those spin art things you do at carnivals or the loopy graphics that Roger Corman movies used to use when Peter Fonda took an acid trip. The instructions were coming quickly now.
A quietness of spirit permeates your body and mind, and we are now going to begin to work together to create the reality you desire to live. And I'm going to begin by giving you several positive suggestions which will be communicated to every level of your body and mind. Now, you are open to these suggestions, which you will accept and act upon. You are self-reliant and self-confident. You are filled with independence.
Well, I don't think I was ever actually hypnotized, but then again, how would I know? I do know that after giggling nervously for the first few minutes, I found the tape extremely relaxing. I'd recommend it just as a way to unwind after a tough day. As for the self-confidence stuff, I don't think it really took hold. Other than going out the next day and submitting myself for a Pulitzer Prize and then asking Terry Gross for the big money I really think I'm worth, I haven't noticed anything different.
Ken, snap out of it. Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Here's a look at the next fresh air. For years, Dutch actor Jeroen Krabbé was consigned to roles in American movies as Cold War villains. It took his portrayal as a lecherous émigré writer in Crossing Delancey to change that. Next time, Krabbé talks about his Dutch and American movies and his role in Scandal as a Soviet diplomat. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Will the Circle Be Unbroken, Volume 2, by the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. And guest film critic Owen Gleiberman reviews Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet. Production assistance from Lisa Bruton and Ed Doherty. Research assistance from Christopher Cook and Laura Civitz. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Burgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.